I am Low.
With an AboveTopSecret.com podcast and the issue of the CDC's proposed rules for its ability to quarantine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, otherwise known as the CDC, wants to update quarantine rules ahead of any bird flu entering the United States. It wants easier access to airline and cruise passenger lists. It wants clear authority to offer treatment. And most importantly, it wants the right to quarantine people it believes to be sick, even in cases of domestic travel. Over the past year and a half, the CDC increased the number of quarantine stations at airports, shipports, and land border crossings from 8 to 18. What is the new standard they propose to apply? A mere temperature of 100.4 degrees, coupled with a lay assessment of additional symptoms such as rash, swollen lymph glands, headache, difficulty breathing, or a mere cough. The next time a flight attendant offers you a drink, she may be trying to decide whether or not to turn you in. Sound like a paranoid thought? Perhaps. But the question you need to ask yourself is, in our rush to respond to a potential global pandemic, are we overreaching? Earlier this week, the CDC held a conference call to provide an explanation to their proposed changes. Once you've listened to the call, ask yourself whether or not their explanations match with the language found in the proposed rules. A copy of the rules can be found on the CDC's website at www.cdc.gov. Are we talking about the protection of our populace, or another opportunity for the abuse of power? You be the judge.
Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Jennifer Marcone. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Sitting here with me is Dr. Marty Cetron, Director of our Division of Global Migration and Quarantine, and Dr. Ram Kapaka, I'm going to spell that for you, R-A-M-K-O-P-P-A-K-A. He's Associate Director for Policy and Preparedness in the Division. Dr. Cetron is going to make some introductory comments, and then we'll open it up for QA. Marty?
Thanks very much for joining me on this call. We would like to use this opportunity to sort of formally put forward that CDC today proposed some critical updates to existing regulations, which will allow our agency and HHS to move more swiftly to control potential outbreaks of infectious disease that may result from international importation or interstate movement. These proposed regulations are on display in the Federal Register for public comment, and they will be posted in the Federal Register on Wednesday, November 30th, for a 60-day period. And we look forward to the opportunity to receive public comment on these notice of proposed rulemaking. These regulations are an important step and one of many steps that CDC is taking to enhance our preparedness to respond to global emerging infectious disease threats and the globalization of infectious diseases and its translocation across borders. And we feel that along with other steps in enhancing our nation's preparedness, there's some critical activities that are in place, and we're very pleased to see that this announcement is being made today and look forward to moving this ahead in a high-priority manner. Let me just end the opening comments by highlighting, I think, three of the important areas where these regulations have been revised. One, we've expanded the definition of ill passengers that is in the previous regulations, and these are 42 CFR Part 70 for interstate movement and Part 71 for international arrivals. And we've critically added the definition of fever and influenza-like illness, which is fever, cough, and sore throat, to the other definitions that were included in ill passengers, which require reporting from captains of conveyances. And these will enable a more rapid advance notification of ill passengers upon arrival and prior to arrival. We've also clarified the requirements for maintaining passenger manifests and holding those that information of passenger name, seat location, and emergency contact information for a period of 60 days after the arrival of that international conveyance for international airlines and cruise ship passengers, and the requirement to submit that information electronically to CDC upon request in a short duration of time. We've also, in the third major change to the regulations, have been very explicit about the due process provisions in attempting to clarify the aspects of due process which balance individual civil liberties against public health, public good, in terms of these regulations, which were largely silent on a lot of the issues of due process in the past. So these are the three main areas that are changed from the existing regulations. I think that that sort of summarizes the general remarks, and I'm happy to open the phone line to questions for either Dr. Kapak or myself.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone. To withdraw your request, you may press star followed by 2. Once again, star 1 if you would like to ask a question. Thank you. Our first question comes from Paul Shin with New York Daily News.
Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Cetron. I was wondering on the domestic interstate flights, whether, you know, how, which flights would be affected by the changes in the regulations, and also in the past, how frequently was the quarantine and isolation regulations invoked?
Let me sort of clarify both parts of your question. With regard to domestic interstate flights, it really applies to the large and medium hub cities as defined by FAA, and there is a listing of those that are available in the text. So it is not every single interstate flight or small charter or small city airport, but really a listing of those that are predominantly involved in large-scale movements. The second question about how common is isolation and quarantine probably needs a little bit of clarifying remarks. Let me just distinguish what isolation and quarantine are as tools in the public health toolbox for controlling emerging infectious disease. Isolation refers to the limitation or restriction of movement and separation of persons that are ill with a communicable disease. And this is a practice that's been in use in public health and in medical circles for a long time. It's typically something that's done at the state and local level or in hospitals and used on a daily basis for separating folks who are infectious with tuberculosis or other common contagious diseases. Quarantine, on the other hand, refers to the separation and or restricted movement of those persons exposed to communicable diseases who are not yet ill. They're typically in the incubation period of one of these illnesses, and that incubation period may vary with time. It's also possible that during the asymptomatic state of that incubation period, persons may or may not be communicable with the disease to which they were exposed. But in that asymptomatic incubating period, if one restricts the movement of such individuals, that's referred to from a public health aspect as quarantine. These tools have been long used as parts of the public health toolbox for centuries. And typically, public health recommendations are made as recommendations and are requested on a voluntary basis for compliance. And the vast majority of cases, whether it is individuals or in population groups, voluntary compliance with public health recommendations is all that is needed to assure public safety. In rare circumstances, public health authorities, principally at the state and local level, have the legal power through state regulations to compel or to
order compulsory compliance with isolation or quarantine at the public health school. And in the setting of these regulations, which apply to the federal jurisdiction for compulsory use of isolation and quarantine, they apply to, in Part 71, to international arrivals, and in Part 70, to interstate movement. And these are areas where there is clear federal jurisdiction regarding isolation and quarantine at public health schools. And they've been long-standing regulations, and what this announcement today is really a modernization of those regulations in order to be better prepared for 21st century threats.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maren McKenna with the Atlanta Journal.
Hi, thanks for doing this. My main question is, in the past, when the issue of maintaining passenger manifests and delivering them when the CDC, when requested, has been raised, the main concern raised in response has been that passengers will feel that it is a violation of their privacy rights. So could you talk a bit about how you manage that negotiation with the airlines and transportation companies, if you did?
That's a great question, Maren, and thank you for that. And the notice, the details of this regulation are just being made public today. So we are incurring a period of public comment on this. And so this hasn't been negotiated out there, in the industry or in the public forum. And that's part of the process that we're engaging in right now. But I think the really getting at the heart of your question is how does public health assure privacy in meeting its responsibilities to carry out its actions? And I think that there are some very rigorous standards of privacy with which this information will be treated on a confidential basis. The confidentiality and privacy concerns are spelled out very clearly in the language of the proposed rule. In addition, we have found that through surveys that have been done of the public through Robert Blendon and his team at Harvard School of Public Health, as well as other surveys that have been done, there is actually a public expectation that CDC and public health officials have the ability to contact them in the event that they sat next to or were exposed to a serious communicable disease. And very much when asked those questions, while they maintained some of their individual concerns about privacy, by and large they were outweighed by their more significant concern that they be reachable so that interventions and mitigation of the risk could be entertained. And well over 90%, I believe, in surveys of both domestic and international passengers have indicated this. While they reserved some concerns, they were far more concerned about being inaccessible. With respect to the airlines, I think that the airlines' issues around privacy have to do with having some clarity on the part of the federal government about what is expected so that clarity could be conveyed to passengers in advance, and that for limited circumstances such as public health use and with maintaining the confidentiality of records through the security systems that are in place, the information would be released for those purposes and not any others. And by being able to spell that out up front and ask passengers either at the time of purchase or potentially at the time of departure if they're willing to share their contact information for public health response purposes, I think it actually makes things easier than leaving it ambiguous with the airline industries about whether to voluntarily turn over such records when requested by CDC. So I'm hoping and optimistic, but the public comment period will validate this expectation that, in fact, there'll be a fair amount of support for our ability to do this as specified in the new regs.
Next question, please. We're ready for the next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lisa Stark with ABC News.
Hi, a couple quick questions. In trying to read through some of this document, it also talks about, say, provisional quarantines for 3 days and things like that. I'm trying to understand if that's something new or if that's something that always existed and you're just reiterating it. And the second question is, could you be a little more specific on what would be some of the due process provisions that you're putting in place?
Sure. Let me take the second part first. By and large, as states review their and have reviewed in the last several years as part of emergency public health preparedness, reviewing their own state legal authorities, there is concern and consideration taken for standard components of due process. Some of these include written notification, providing a rationale and justification for an effort, that an effort be scientifically and medically justified as a need to control, that these approaches be taken, be used the least restrictive means necessary to accomplish the goals, that there be an opportunity for filing a dispute and hearing a dispute by an independent arbiter. These are some standard components of due process, which assure some of that delicate balance that we think needs to be in place. The previous regulations had largely been silent about the specifics on how we would actually operationalize and conduct these processes, and these regulations make much more explicit the components of due process that are to be in place. So while you rightly pointed out in your first question, there was this sort of 3-day or 72-hour kind of temporary holding period, which is needed to conduct an emergency response at a point of entry, that once that time has passed, a definitive decision needs to be made and issued by the director regarding a quarantine order or not, and that just is a part of the stepwise pieces that would go into place, and that the temporary holding or detention for assessment would take no longer than that period of 72 hours before a formal written order would be issued. While we may have actually acted along these lines, in the past under the older regulations, this makes it quite a bit more explicit, and I think puts forward those pieces of due process that I spoke of earlier.
Next question.
Thank you. Betsy McKay with the Wall Street Journal. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Stetson. Thank you. I'd like to follow up, if I could, on some of Marin's questions a few minutes ago about passenger manifests. One is, I'm wondering if you could describe in a little bit more detail what is changing here in terms of what you're asking from the airlines and what information the passengers are being asked to provide. In other words, were airlines previously required to turn over manifests, or was it a voluntary thing? The other question is, as far as I understand, while airlines would be required, if this regulation goes through, passengers necessarily would not be required to give that information to airlines. So how would that be managed, or would they be required?
Those are great questions, Betsy, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify. Let me be real clear about the way things used to be done and what the challenges are, and then highlight the specific fixes that are taken in this rule. Often, more often than not, the vast majority of times in the era of rapid jet travel, notifications of significant public health events might occur after passengers have disembarked from planes. And public health would be left to reconstruct an itinerary, a manifest, a seating chart, and any contact information based on what existed at the time, depending on how long after the event that disease notification occurred, which could be days, sometimes even longer than days, waiting for a positive laboratory report from a state lab or something like that. And what would happen is, because of the volume of international travel, some of the early electronic records of those manifests are purged very quickly, often within 24, 48 hours or shortly thereafter, depending on the airline in maintaining that database. So these records would then need to be reconstructed by hand, and that often would only have a name and maybe a seat location at best. It wouldn't include sufficient contact information for public health authorities to actually find that person and intervene within the incubation period. We would then be going to customs declaration forms on international arrivals and try to pick those handwritten papers out of a warehouse somewhere and reconstruct them and identify the contact information from there and try to enter it into a database and then go back and try to find those people through state and local health officials. This was an extremely time-consuming process, even for a single flight, and almost hopelessly unsuccessful when we had to deal with large multiple flights and large volume contact tracing as occurred during SARS. So the specific changes here are requirements that passenger manifests be maintained by airlines in electronic format for 60 days after the final destination of that journey, that at the request of public health, that information need to be turned over in less than a day, by and large in 12 hours of that request, and that the information be turned over to public health authorities electronically, and that specific fields be included to allow for effective contact tracing.
And these are now requirements that are proposed in this notice of proposed rulemaking to facilitate public health's ability to intervene swiftly in sort of a 21st century approach, when often there's only hours or days to implement countermeasures, to offer post-exposure vaccination or antibiotics, antivirals, or to separate people who've been exposed from others who are unexposed. In addition, you raised the question about whether individuals themselves would be required to provide this information or whether it would be voluntary. And this was discussed a lot as we put together this proposed rule. And largely this is a voluntary requirement, but made as an active request either at the time of purchase of the ticket or at the time of check-in. And what we're asking for is a plan for the airlines to come up with a proposal and a plan for how they would accomplish this. We do think that when given the rationale, and that is to respond to an emergent public health event, you know, like a SARS event or exposure to meningococcal meningitis or other serious significant public health conditions, that most people would in fact voluntarily comply with, you know, assurances that the information would be kept confidential and their privacy maintained and not used for other than emergent public health purposes. And so we're hopeful and optimistic that we'll have a fairly high degree of compliance with a voluntary request that's made from the airlines to the individuals for this information.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Rick Weiss with The Washington Post. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm wondering who is actually making the diagnosis or this, or making the decision that someone or some group of people are suspected of being contagious or communicable. It sounds like it's the director, but I don't think the director is walking down the aisle of the plane looking at everyone's eyes.
No. There's a part of, as I indicated earlier in the opening, updating regulatory authorities and jurisdiction is only part of an enhanced preparedness plan to deal with communicable diseases that travel around the globe. Another key part is expanding the capacity of our quarantine stations at ports of entry. And many of you may know that over the last 18 months, we've added from a baseline of 8 quarantine stations, 10 additional stations, and are currently at 18 at major international points of arrival, and have phased in proposals for expanding further contingent on budget and resource allocation. By doing this, in addition to expanding the locations of these stations at ports of entry, we've also changed the skill set significantly and have added back quarantine medical officers to the ports of entry in addition to senior public health advisors. And it would be their responsibility, if requested by anybody, whether it's a captain of a conveyance who reports in advance, whether it's a CBP inspector who notices something at the point of disembarkation or arrival through customs, or whether it is a public health official who raises a flag, you know, either in advance or after the fact. The quarantine medical officers, together with the state and local public health departments, will be making these assessments and determinations. And therein lies that the component that's in the reg for this 72-hour temporizing capacity for these medical officers before a decision is made by the CDC director.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Larry Altman with the New York Times. Your line is now open.
Yes. First of all, where are all these regs written out? Because I'm a mess, but I don't have them. And where can I look at them? And secondly, what are the listings now? You're saying you're adding fever, influenza. What are they now, and how does this expand it? I realize possibly with the written document I could find that, but I don't have it.
Okay. Well, firstly, Larry, we can get you a copy of the written document, but they will be posted for display in the Federal Register in the morning and in the Federal.
That does no good, but we're writing a story today.
We can get you to them. If we send you after this the website, our website, we have them posted by section, and you can look at that immediately. As well, they'll be posted in writing in the Federal Register. We've broken them down by section on our website for your ease in making reference to them. And the other question was what is currently in the definition of an ill passenger. And if you go to the website, this will be in section 8, actually, in the specific comments on the reg text. Line number 3199 or 3200, which may or may not be outlined that way, but page 142 has the definition of an ill person in it. And this is someone with a temperature of 38 centigrade or 100.4 or greater, accompanied by one or more of the following: rash, swelling of the lymph nodes or glands, headache with neck stiffness, and changes in level of consciousness or cognitive function. Fever, diarrhea, fever and that has persisted for more than 48 hours, fever associated with severe bleeding, jaundice, or severe persistent cough accompanied by bloody sputum, respiratory distress. So these are some of the changes or nuances in the definition of ill passengers. And then the last caveat is signs and symptoms that are suggestive of communicable diseases, which the director may describe in an order as the director determines necessary, and this is to deal with emerging constellation of emerging threats that currently are unknown, for example, in the situation of SARS. But largely, the definition was modified to really take into account the respiratory components and the neurologic components that are compatible with the list of 9 diseases that are currently specified by presidential executive order as quarantinable diseases.
And for everyone's reference, we apologize that they're not available at the Federal Register. The regulations are posted at www.cdc.gov/NCIDOD/DQ. They're available there now. Next question, please.
Thank you. Mike Stobie with the Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Hi, Doctor. Just two clarifying questions. So following Dr. Altman's question, for those symptoms, what's the significance of the addition to that definition? These are symptoms that if they're detected by a ship captain or something, they can, how are those definitions put into use or effect?
These are requirements for ship's captain or the captain of a conveyance, whether it's a ship or airplane. If these symptoms, compatible symptoms, are noticed in a passenger on a flight or on a ship, there's a requirement for that captain of the conveyance to report this information to the quarantine station of jurisdiction. And really the most efficient and effective responses are those that come with advance notification prior to landing, which allow for pre-positioning of public health medical personnel to assess and evaluate individuals in advance at the time that the ship is about or plane is about to disembark, so that contact information could be obtained in real time, assessments could be made in real time, and separation of ill persons from well persons can be made sort of prior to the disembarkation and scattering and onward connecting flights of the many individuals. So these are requirements of captains of conveyances to notify public health authorities, specifically quarantine stations that have jurisdiction over the port of entry.
Next question, please.
Thank you. John Richard with Congressional Quarterly. Your line is open. Thank you. We'll go on to the next question. Christine Gorman from Time Magazine.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering how many reports were sent to the CDC of ill passengers in a given year, let's say, prior to this new proposed rule, and how do you think this new proposed rule will affect that number?
Well, that's a great question, and I can't give you a specific answer to it right at the time, but we can look into it and try to get back to you. Your point is a good one, and let me just back up by saying, in general, what happens is the majority of our ill passenger reports really come after the fact. And so what we have now is a very passive system that we occasionally can enhance with awareness and education through various networks to get greater reporting. And during SARS and during large-scale public health emergencies, the degree of reporting in advance in comparison to after-the-fact reporting was increased dramatically through what we call enhanced passive surveillance.
There is also opportunities to do active surveillance and to physically have quarantine and medical officers reviewing and assessing people at the point of arrival along with their surrogates. In reality, the volume of these reports varies by station, it varies by the volume of arrival, it varies by the nature of the conveyance, the age distribution of the conveyance. There are some cruise ships which cater to elderly or particularly infirmed or persons with chronic disabilities, for which the nature of some of those reports are much higher. Most reporting, I really wish to emphasize, most reporting of ill events and persons who were traveling ill and ill while they were on an international conveyance or an interstate conveyance actually happens after the fact through traditional public health system surveillance, and the quarantine station staff and the federal public health response needs to retrospectively reconstruct the itinerary, the exposures, those at risk, the nature of the communicability at the time of travel, and all of those things, so that the vast majority of our incoming reports are really after the fact and not meeting with the requirements for notification by the captain of conveyances in flight. And we hope to stimulate a more enhanced system of passive reporting in the absence of an emergency in order to better respond and respond more swiftly.
That concludes part one. For part two, listen to reply to this podcast.